unfathomable fragments. Mornings and evenings, we found, were the best times for seeing Botos, just as Vera had said. This is true of many animals, who take advantage of the cool of the day and the transition from dark to light to forage, to play, or to hunt while their prey is active. But to us, it seemed as if dawn and sunset called them. Like a beautiful woman is drawn to her own reflection, the pink forms rose from the water as if to greet the clouds that glowed pink with the rising and setting of the sun. They surfaced all around us. We would hear a breath, a splash, and we would spin around to see patches of rose and dusk skimming the water surface. Sometimes it seemed they would pop up through the water like corks. Other times it was as if they slowly gathered themselves from the water itself. And then, after just a second at the surface, they would sink from sight. We would stare at the wake, transfixed, as if it were an opening through which we might see the vanished animal, as if somehow the ripples, like one of those magic eye images, would suddenly fly into focus and make sense. But of course this never happened. And because we were staring at the wake, we would nearly miss the next sighting, which might be 100 yards away or right at the side of our boat. Always, it seemed, in the opposite direction from where we'd last seen one. The only thing we could tell for sure was the difference between a boto and a tukushi. If we could tell what it wasn't a boto. None of these sightings were anything like watching marine dolphins in aquaria. In a clear water tank, you can always see the entire animal. And besides, the trained Atlantic bottlenose not only leaps obligingly out of the water for its audience, but often suspends itself halfway, its head and upper torso visible, like a person treading water in a pool. Neither did our glimpses match the images of botos we'd seen in films, photos, or illustrations. These, too, either showed the entire animal or at least a large portion of the body. Many of the photographs were of animals that had been hauled out of the water in nets. One dolphin, which we'd seen in a book in Vera's office, was actually lying on a mattress. Once we got to the floating house, we noticed its fabric matched exactly those of the mattresses we were sleeping on. The documentary clips, I later discovered, were all filmed in semi-captive situations when the dolphins had been cordoned off in clear shallows. But to us, the botos came only in fragments. Once, a pink tail waved at us clearly as a person hailing a cab. Another time, about 100 yards away, a boto raised his head out of the water, spy-hopping like a huge California gray whale. But mostly, all we saw was the top of a head or the curve of a dorsal fin. Not an entire creature, but a flash of color and shape. We had to learn how to see them, to develop what is called the search image, to process what these pieces really were, dolphins. We looked desperately. That was a mess. Should I start from but mostly?
Yeah.
But mostly, all we saw was the top of a head or the curve of a dorsal fin, not an entire creature, but a flash of color and shape. We had to learn how to see them, to develop what is called the search image, to process that these pieces really were dolphins. We looked desperately for markings that could allow us to identify individuals. This is a standard first step in studying animals, and often discovering the key characteristic to look for represents the first breakthrough. In studying mountain gorillas, Diane Fossey had found that each animal had an individual nose print. Studying African elephants, Cynthia Moss looked for distinctive notches in the ears. Tigers have individual patterns of stripes, and some Indian researchers believe individual footprints. Vera had tried to look for scars or notches on the dorsal fins of her dolphins. When a female is in estrus, males will fight viciously with one another, Vera explained, so there is ample opportunity to leave scars. So on our second evening, when we saw one dolphin with a particularly flat dorsal fin and another with a V notched into his, we were overjoyed. But botos do not show their dorsals on every dive. In fact, they never seem to reveal to us the same angle. We never saw those two again. Or if we did, we didn't recognize them. Neither could we recognize animals by size. Sometimes, when an animal dove in an arcing roll, we could tell when we were watching a particularly big or small dolphin. but botos don't always dive this way. They can float up and sink down the way helicopters fly, and in these cases only reveal the melon or the top of the head or the dorsal ridge. Once, we knew we were looking at a youngster. The head was so small. He would have been about a year old, as most births occur from May through July when the waters are highest or falling. But generally, we had no idea of size or age because such a tiny fragment of the animal was visible at a time, and for only a short moment. The only clear feature of each sighting was color. Sometimes we were treated to particularly vivid flamingo pink. Other times all we saw was a dark gray. Many of the dolphins appeared to be mottled. But since we often had to look directly into the sun, and we almost always saw them at times the skies were changing, we knew even this could be an artifact of light. In fact, the dolphins actually do change color, though no one knows why. They may glow pinker with exertion or with age, or their color might change with temperature and turbidity of the water. "I know what our problem is," Diane said to me as the creatures seemed to morph before our eyes. "These aren't dolphins. They're chameleons." No wonder so little is known about them. Although Inia was first collected by Alexandra Rodriguez Ferreira around 1790, little knowledge has been obtained since then about its biology, Vera and her husband wrote in a paper detailing the first 7 years of their work. Theirs was the first, and still considered the only, major ecological study to be published on the species. From pooling data with biologists studying botos in Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador, and from themselves patrolling thousands of miles of river at a leisurely 7 miles per hour, the couple determined the boto's range is enormous. The species is found in most of the major tributaries of both the Amazon and the Orinoco, with the exception of the lower reaches of the Xingu River at the mouth of the Amazon and the southern half of the Tapajós. And when the wet season floods the land, the dolphins enter every riverine habitat in the Amazon basin, from grasslands to treetops. The couple also collected carcasses of dead botos. They measured them, they dissected the bodies, they measured the organs, they counted the parasites. Vera was particularly eager to look in their stomachs to see what they ate. A 1970 report claiming that botos compete with fishermen had sparked her initial interest in the species. Less than half the fish they ate are commercially important, Vera found, and these are taken in relatively small quantities. For botos can eat almost anything. With big conical teeth and strong jaws, a boto can break a turtle shell. In several stomachs, she has found rock-hard armored catfish with erectile spines. Botos will take some 50 species of fish, and in a single meal might consume more different kinds of fish than any other species of dolphin might eat in a lifetime. But as important as these findings are, Vera's papers still detail a litany of unknowns. Virtually nothing is known about the physiology of Inia. Its overall abundance is unknown. Where these animals go during the dry season is unknown. There's been little research on Inia in most of the countries where it's found. There are insufficient data to be analyzed for trends of any population. No one knows when the breeding season is, if there is any. No one knows the structure of social groups, if they exist. At the meeting of the waters, Vera found she could not even begin to chronicle the dolphins' lives. "They are not easy animals to study in the main river," she explained to us later. "It's too wide. The animals seem to flicker at the edge of our consciousness, a movement at the corner of the field of vision, a spume of breath that lingered after the animal dove, fragments we could not hope to unite into meaning. But occasionally, a glimpse called to us like a snatch of vaguely remembered melody. One day, at 5 p.m., after Nildon had stilled our boat by wedging it into the crown of a drowned kariru tree, three of them came. Two swam close together. A third seemed to have arrived alone. In Vera's research, most of the botos sighted were solitary, and groups greater than two were seldom encountered. 12 to 26% of the observations Vera analyzed were pairs like this one. Probably, she concluded, mother and calf. The bond between mother and offspring is very close. Vera has found they stay together for at least 2.5 years. We'd seen photos of mothers and young swimming together, often one on top of the other, their long snouts touching, one flipper trailing along the other's flesh, the way a child holds a parent's hand simply for the comfort of touch. 4 times the two Botos surfaced within 50 yards of our boat, inches from one another, and I imagined, though I could not see, that they swam touching, for they are sensuous animals. An observer at Germany's Duisburg Zoo, which has housed 2 Botos since 1975, recorded the dolphins blowing curtains of bubbles through which one or the other would then swim. In one case, the elder dolphin, Vater, grabbed a scrub brush left in the tank as a toy. Pulling it quickly downward through the water in his mouth, he created along the whole length of the handle a rising curtain of prickling and glittering air bubbles. The younger dolphin, Baby, then rose in the water and rolled in the bubbles, obviously with great pleasure. "The purpose of the air bubbles," wrote Wolfgang Gewalt, "seems to be the benefit of a special kind of caressing massage, similar to whirlpools." In captivity, Botos are inventive lovers. After foreplay, in which the male nibbles gently at the female's flippers and flukes, they make love in at least 3 different positions. Head to head, head to tail, and at right angles. They may indulge in this 47 times in 3.5 hours. Both sexes masturbate, the male rubbing his penis against objects, the female inserting objects into her vagina or pressing against it. Males sometimes use the sensitive penis as an exploratory probe, even inserting it into another dolphin's blowhole. "The Boto's pursuit of sensual pleasures," Gewalt wrote, "seemed more highly developed than any similar behavior known up to now from other cetaceans, either free living or kept in the zoo." And then we saw the young dolphins slowly roll in the water. Languidly, the baby turned, revealing a chubby pink belly and paddle-shaped flippers spread akimbo. For a long moment, with his mother beside him, the yearling floated at the surface on his back, as if he were savoring the feel of the sun warming his skin, and then, equally, the way the river reclaimed his body in its cooling welcome. How I wanted to join them! Vera had spoken with us of the same longing. "Sometimes it's my desire to swim with them," she had told us in her office at Impa. "But there are piranhas. The water looks nice, but I always think of the piranhas." She has friends who've been badly bitten. She's found Botos with crescent-shaped hunks taken out of the skin, the work of razor-sharp teeth. "And when we catch the Boto to Friesbrand, we make a circle with our net," she had told us. "We pulled the net out, this new net, a beautiful brand-new net, and it came out like a rag. The piranhas destroyed it." "Anything might be in these waters," she had warned. "You may feel something touching you, but you do not know what it is. It can be a piece of wood, it can be a grass, it can be a snake, it can be a piranha, it can be a stingray, it can be a shark. We have caught in the Solomoys River 4 huge sharks, 2.5 meters, and it's a marine shark. It comes in the Amazon and can be found all the way to Iquitos in Peru. They're almost the same color as the water. When they come here, they get mud on the skin. So," Vera told us, "I will not swim with dolphins." Never before had I felt so separate from water. There was us, there was the surface, and there was the impenetrable world below. Anything might be in these waters. I remember the legends about the Boto's enchanted underwater city, which people deeply fear. But their fear is tinged with desire. I had read that shamans will sometimes seek out dolphins, contacting them in dreams or in ecstasies induced by hallucinogenic drugs or snuff, and ask them to show them the secrets of the Ankant. The people know the river is dangerous, but beneath the river, they say, is a place of unimaginable riches, the treasures of lost souls, pleasures to quench every desire. The dolphins there preside over a world where there is no longing, only music and singing and dancing. Sometimes, it's said, you can hear snatches of their songs. Sometimes we heard strange sounds underneath us. The bottom of our boat was a stethoscope to an unknown beneath. Early one morning, we heard the high-pitched whine of an electric current. What could it be? Pescada, answered Neil Dalton. Fish. Then we saw one dolphin take off like a shot beside our boat. Muito rápido, exclaimed Neil Dalton. El boto fazer compras. The boto is shopping. He was chasing a fish. After we had watched them for an hour, the dolphins disappeared at 6:34 that morning. We waited and waited. Kingfishers zoomed like arrows across the brown water. An electric green parrot screamed from the top of a tree. We listened to fruits falling into the water. But we saw no more dolphins, heard no more breath. By 8:45, the heat was gathering like a cloud of gnats. The dolphins did not return. So we headed to Marchanteria, the floodplain lake named after a grassy island there, 6 miles upriver along the Rio Solimões. Vera had picked 5 checkpoints from which she had tried to identify individuals as they entered and left the lake. This time of year, Vera had told us, the botos come to the lake following fish, who go there to eat the fruits dropping from the trees into the flooded forest. Our days and nights on the river were punctuated by the splash of the ripe fruits the trees released into the river. In the rainy season, there's fruit for everyone. The monkeys and parrots, the fruit bats and bamboo rats, the dainty brocket deer, and the strange snouted tapir, a four-toed forest dweller who looks like a cross between an elephant, a rhino, and a pig. But the trees do not make their fruits for birds or mammals to eat and disperse, as most fruit trees do. To carry their seeds to the locations where they will grow and feed these many mouths, the trees here make their fruits for fish. Nowhere else on earth do fish depend on seeds and fruit for a major part of the year. But in the Amazon, the trees release their seeds to voyage on the water. More than 200 species of fruit-eating fish migrate into the flooded forest to gorge and to spawn. The fruit embarks on a journey of rebirth, and its splash is the first note in an unheard symphony of accommodations between water and trees, trees and fish, fish and mammals. The trees here have evolved ways to make their fruit attractive to fish and easy to find. Most fruits float. Many of the fruit trees, such as laurels and cinnamons, produce fragrant organic latexes, oils, resins, and acids. The fish wait beneath these trees, drawn by the scent. Some, like the tambaqui, have developed nasal flaps on the upper part of the snout to help them smell these fruits. To crush the seeds of the serengera tree, tambaqui have molars like those of horses and huge, powerful jaws. Others, like the ancient black-armored catfishes, swallow the stone-like seeds of palm fruits whole and digest the fleshy covering. The seeds pass through the gut and are defecated whole, where they can germinate in a new location. There, once the waters recede, they do not have to compete with the parent tree, nor attempt to fight its shade. It is tempting to hypothesize that fish and trees have evolved in a mutualistic relation, Michael Golding, one of the leading experts on Amazon fish, has written. The sustaining relationship between fish and trees here has certainly been noted by the people who've lived for centuries along the rivers that flood these forests. One of the central myths of Amazonian people is the story of the world tree, which in many river cultures is said to be full of the water that gave birth to the Amazon and its fishes. As the Shipibo myth tells it, the world began this way. When the sun first emerged, it hit the branches of the world tree, which released its luscious fruits into the lake like rain. Fish rose to the surface to eat the fruit. From the bites the fish took emerged all the species of birds in the world, connecting the water with the sky. And at the edges of the day, at the times when dolphins come, at the times the clouds gather, the world recreates itself from water anew. The scientists now tell us that life itself lifts up from the water like a spirit to seed the clouds. Oxford and East Anglia University scientists have proposed that a gas emitted by many algae, dimethyl sulfide, evolved to allow small tropical microbes to rise from the water and take to the air. And this same gas, they note, is well known as the primary natural source of airborne particles around which water droplets form to create clouds. The organisms do this, suggest the scientists, for the same reason trees make fruit, to speed them on their journey toward new life. In the heart-quickening thunderstorms that soaked our nights in Brazil, these tiny lives were riding the rain back to Earth. The legendary Greek philosopher Thales of Miletus, whom Aristotle considered 2 centuries later to be the founder of the physical sciences, believed that all matter consists ultimately of water. That is easy to believe here. Despite Vera's warning, I put my hand into the soupy lake. It feels thick and alive, not just fluid, but tissue, like skin and blood. This is not merely a medium for life, I thought. The water is life, itself alive. Travelers have long written of being overwhelmed by the immensity of the Amazon, a vast inland sea, as explorer Henry Walter Bates called it. The river stretches 4,000 miles, discharging 14 times the daily flow of the Mississippi. Its jungle spreads for 2.5 million square miles, a forest the size of the face of the full moon, anthropologist Wade Davis observes. But to me, the immensity of the Amazon was here at my fingertips as I put my hand into the living water. The immensity of the Amazon is in its unfathomable wholeness, a wholeness forever giving birth to a universe unimaginably strange and perfect and unseen. And this, I knew, was the source of my longing to follow the dolphins. Though I was drawn by the fragmentary glimpses they'd shown me at the surface, I was compelled by their siren strangeness, their immersion in the wholeness of the unknown world below. After 45 minutes' travel, we arrived at a flooded meadow. The tassel-like seed heads of the grasses smelled sweet as orchids. Egrets flashed bright against the sun. There's another IMPA floating research station here, and we stopped by to speak with some visiting German scientists to see if they'd seen BOTUS. They'd seen 2 that morning, and more would be coming soon. As the rains continued, the water was expected to rise another meter in the next week. We journeyed farther, the motor at a low purr as we scanned the water. Each small wave seemed to gather itself into a promise, seemed to darken and quicken, as we prayed for a pink fin to arise, like the limb of a baby breaching from a dark womb. But then the wave would dissolve into itself, and hope vanished as completely as a fruit swallowed by a fish. The sun was so hot it stung our skin. Sweat poured into our eyes as we squinted into the glare. Each night, our sleep had been fragmented by lightning storms and downpours. As Diane swore in various languages, we had to get up and secure the shutters in the middle of the night. Once awake, we then realized ants were crawling on us, a fact that had mercifully been concealed while we were asleep. So we were exhausted as well as hot. My Portuguese was so poor I couldn't really converse with Nildon except to ask, "Onde fica Boto?" Where are the dolphins? Which I realized must have sounded like a complaint. Nildon, who was eager to please us, but who could not produce dolphins on demand, would shake his head and reply with disgust, "Nau ha boto aqui hoje." There are no botos here today. He piloted the boat over to the island, where we saw 2 other boats and the hunched-over forms of 5 men working with nets. There were a team of electric fish experts from IMPA, 2 of whom, to my delight, spoke English. A hefty young man in a wide-brimmed Panama hat introduced himself as José Gómez. Wiry, thin Paulo Petri was wearing a camouflage hat and horn-rimmed glasses. They were bent over a big black net, hauling out wet masses of water hyacinth as glittering dragonflies swarmed around them. Periodically, José inserted into the weeds a long bamboo pole with a voltmeter attached. It crackled with the current of electric fish. "Each species has its own signal," explained José. "The signals sent from the electric organs, which are similar to muscle tissue, are picked up by the electric receptors of other individuals. An individual fish can alter the shape of the electric field, the waveform of the discharge frequency, and the timing patterns between signals to send different types of information. Had we heard fish signaling one another beneath our boat that morning? What were they saying to one another? Experiments in captivity show electric fish can convey to others their species, their sex, and their age class. They give territorial warnings like birds. In some species, the broadcast can carry 32 feet. The behavior is incredible, said Jose. They use these signals, he said, in social interactions to detect objects, for dominance, to find mates. There are so many things we're trying to understand. In the Ankant, beneath the water's surface, in the language of electricity, these tiny fish sing songs of lust and fear and courage. Operas played out on a vast underwater stage. These fish's current isn't dangerous to people. Unlike electric eels, who aren't actually eels at all, but are themselves a kind of fish, they emit only a fraction of a volt. But Paolo called out, "Cuidado, cuidado! Careful!" A 5-inch catfish was embedded in the tangle of vegetation, and it erects 3 toxin-tipped spines to turn itself into a poisoned trident spear when threatened. The IMPA team, Jose explained, was looking for a particular species of electric fish. They are transparent, shaped like streamers, long, thin triangles with no back or side fins. We didn't find the one we were looking for, said Paolo. They knew from the voltmeter that this family was not in the net. But instead, there was a surprise. They had come up with an eel unknown to science, a foot-long creature apparently belonging to a different family, Cymbranchidae, whose pronounced jaw gives it a triangular head like a viper. Last year, there were only 2 new eel species reported in all of South America, Paolo said, shaking out the water weeds. There are 5 new ones from this island in the past 2 years. Among them is a species that makes nests and burrows in the mud in the dry season. They wait out the dry season in a state of suspended animation until the water floods in and brings them back to life. The Amazon's bewildering diversity is unheard of anywhere else on Earth. Michael Goulding, who had generously offered me advice on watching botos, has single-handedly discovered 200 previously unidentified fish species in the 2 decades he's worked in the Amazon. An acquaintance of Diane's, Dutch primatologist Mark van Roosmalen, had gone looking for a new species of marmoset he'd heard about a year ago. In the process, he reportedly discovered 4 other previously unknown primates, a new species of dwarf porcupine, and spotted what he believes to be an undescribed tapir and an unknown subspecies of jaguar. All of them, incredibly, were discovered barely 190 miles from the city of Manaus. How to even begin to fathom such richness and complexity? What was I even doing here, trying to follow an animal I could not see into a world I could never know? Here, drenched in the ferocious light of the Brazilian noon, I understood why fathom is a water word, one we use when we're trying to understand something difficult and deep. In fact, a dictionary definition is to determine the depth of. Another definition of fathom, the verb, is to sound, which is, of course, one way the dolphins penetrate the meaning of their world. Their eyes, though they appear small, are actually in the skull as large as those of marine dolphins, and they function quite well in air and in clear water. But in the brown murk of the Solimões, the botos rely on their sonar, throwing out a beam of sound to chart their world with its echoes. This is one reason the botos need such flexible necks. As they swim through the flooded forest, they turn the head from side to side, sounding their way through the maze of drowned branches with a series of pulsed clicks at frequencies up to 170,000 hertz, far higher than we can hear. Ordinary sounds would be too inaccurate on account of their longer wavelengths and would not produce a precise enough echo. One researcher has compared the sonar system of river dolphins with an electron microscope. The resolution of an ordinary microscope ends where the object is smaller than the wavelength of light. whereas the electron microscope uses a beam with a shorter wavelength than that of light to detect minuscule items. The BOTO sonar is thought to be the most highly developed of all. Alone among the whales, they can fathom the flooded forest. So I could hope for no better guide to the Amazon than the BOTO. Dolphins have guided humans for millennia. Legends older than the Minoans say dolphins led the ancients to the center of the world, a sanctuary named Delphi in their honor. The Greek sea god Poseidon turned to a dolphin to find his lost bride, a miracle commemorated by the dolphin constellation in the sky. Dolphins carried the souls of the Etruscan dead to the Isle of the Blessed. Dolphins symbolized the Christian soul's rebirth. I looked to the Botos for no less of a miracle. Why was I drawn to follow them? Of course, I wanted to see where they go. But in my heart, I wanted to follow them deeper yet. I wanted to follow them to the Enkant, to the city beneath the waters. I wanted to follow them to Eden. I wanted to follow them back down deep to the watery womb of the world, to the source of strangeness and beauty and desire. I wanted to touch the very soul of the Amazon. The concept of understanding implies probing something deep, something beneath, a search for a beginning or origin. The desire to fathom the world is perhaps our deepest human longing. The word fathom originates in the Old English, meaning outstretched arms, a gesture, I realized, of divine supplication. And if math is the language of God, as the physicists say, it is no wonder that a fathom is also a unit of measure, 6 feet. Measurement is one way science tries to penetrate mystery. We measure voltages, we sort stomach contents, we count botos. But at the meeting of the waters, and at Marchantaria, not even Vera, much less Diane and I, could reliably count botos. So the morning before we returned to Manaus, I measured the one thing I could count, their breaths. As what we believed to be 2 botos surfaced around our canoe, I counted their breaths. They breathed approximately every 2 minutes, 6:06, 6:09, 6:11, 6:13, 6:14, 6:15, 6:17, and then they disappeared. Right before we left, we saw their shadows pass beneath our boat. It was the closest we had come to seeing the animals whole.